Hi, I'm Tully Smythe and I'm here with Uncommon.
This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. Welcome to another episode of Uncommon. My name's Jordan Michaelides and I'm your host. In this episode, I have for you Tully Smythe. Tully is an influencer and host of the Social Squad podcast. Having been thrust into the spotlight and lounge rooms of Australia as a contestant on Big Brother, she soon developed a clear knowledge of how to influence, underlined, I think, by her knowledge from her previous roles as a social media strategist. This interview will give you an understanding of the landscape of influencers and I think how Tully is ultimately misunderstood and what her closest friends see in that friendship, and I think you'd be very surprised. In this episode, we covered a lot, including nerding over books, being misunderstood, her career in advertising, establishing influence, understanding dementia, the Social Squad podcast, and working with Mia Friedman. If you like the episode, do leave a rating on your podcast app. And if you want a shout out at all, leave us a review so we can read it out the following week. Share with your friends, take a screenshot, post on your Instagram story, tagging us at @uncommon_podcast. To watch the episode in full, the video, search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube and don't forget to like and subscribe. Show notes and all previous guests are at neural.com/podcast. With that being said, thanks for listening, guys. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Tully Smythe. Tully, you'd be surprised.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. I just said that you say that phrase a lot.
Yeah.
I've been here for literally 20 minutes and I think you said you'd be surprised 3 times.
Yeah. No, we, I mean.
You could say you'd be surprised again. You were.
You'd be surprised.
You'd be surprised how often I say that usually.
Interesting is a terrible one. Actually, my mum picked up on that the other day and she was like really like gave me a slap of the wrist. Like, you say this word way too often.
It's okay. It's one word. It's hard to say. You'd be surprised, though, is quite an obvious phrase. And if you're repeating it over and over again, it's going to, you know, lose its meaning.
What's your phrase?
Oh, I go through stages. I'll find a word or I'll hear a word and I fall in love with it. I do say facetious a lot.
Okay.
I use it as an excuse. I was just being facetious. And I think it's one of those words that maybe not everybody uses, so it stands out again.
Yeah.
And I think some people think I'm trying to sound smart.
What was your when you studied journalism? I can sort of tell that maybe there was some new words that you discovered and you started to have favourites. Do you remember one in particular where you just really droned on about it?
Do you know what? Firstly, fuck you. I have been a massive reader since I was very little. So my vocab's always been quite extensive, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really learn a word per se during uni. I learned a lot about politics. I went into my degree knowing nothing about politics. And then we had to decide on to pick a subject. It was either literature or politics as an elective. And I just finished 4 units of English. I don't know what you guys have here in Victoria, but I basically did English advanced and then as many extension English as I could do. So I basically did as many English subjects as I could do for my final certificate.
Really?
Yeah. And so I'd just done a lot of literature. And okay. I was like, I kind of want a break. So I chose politics purely out of process of elimination. And I learnt a lot about politics.
Because I remember I did English and literature. Was your literature basically analysis of text, like mm-hmm. books and whatnot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you reckon? I feel like studying English like that, it changes the way you read, the way you watch films. Suddenly you're looking for like, oh, why are they now shooting, you know, in with a red tinge to the lighting? And
it stops you sometimes just enjoying the story.
Yeah, because you're analysing everything.
And I found a really good documentary recently. It's called Myths and Monsters. And it's basically like there's a book that I can never remember the name.
You have a bookshelf right behind you.
It's not. I haven't bought it yet. It's on my list on Amazon.
You need to keep it there so you can just turn around and just be like, whoop.
This is the book. No, I buy these books normally in like batches of 50, and so I'll read them over the course of a year. Because I just get so many books recommended, and then I put them in a list, and then at the end of the year I decide, okay, what do I really want to read for the next year?
Do you have the Goodreads app?
Yeah, I've used Goodreads. One of our prior guests, Lewis Spears, loves Goodreads. Every single book that he reads, he does a Goodreads review with his entire analysis.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot of admin.
It is. I mean, I do this thing. I'm just trying to think.
I like Goodreads because if I've really, really loved a book and say there isn't a sequel or the author hasn't written another one, I like that you can go in there, put the book that you've just loved in. It will tell you books that are similar or books that other people have liked of the same vein.
Yeah.
Kind of can recommend books for you based off your tastes.
Do you note books at all?
No, I don't want to ruin a book with a pen. I don't even fold the pages.
Because I treat my books
with respect.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of bent spines I'm looking at. That gives me anxiety.
Really?
Yeah, you've really fucked that Elon Musk book. Can I swear? I haven't even asked that, and I'm already dropping the F-bomb.
See, this is an example. I don't know if people can
actually
see
that. Holy moly.
Yeah. So I just...
That to me looks like an English textbook that I've had to do that in.
See, yeah, I don't know why I do this. I don't know. I just do it. Like, I can't help myself. There's things
Who's that for, though?
For me.
It's like, do you go back and...
retain it. And then what I do is I put it into, you know, Evernote.
Okay. Wow. This is a whole new level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I put it into Evernote. And so, yeah, the best bits is somehow what gets kept.
Right. Yeah. I'm so glad we opened with this. If you guys are still with us, well done for not falling asleep.
I don't know. I've been told many times I need to get the Kindle.
No, I'm anti-Kindle and anti-iPad,
screens
iBooks.
And all that.
I just think we're on a screen so much already. The best thing about a book, the best thing about getting into bed and putting down my phone and picking up a book is the fact that it's not a screen.
Yeah.
And I know that you can therefore carry around. I the only time I could see it being useful is if it was back when I was younger and I was backpacking. And I used to lug around stacks of books and I get so attached to them that I kind of do that thing where you leave them at a hostel and you switch them, you know, you swap them around for other people. And no, they all came with me, all of them. That's a lot of extra kgs.
How do you treat reading? Like, do you look at it like, okay, I've got this book, I'm 30 pages in, I fucking hate it, but I'm going to pursue it, or do you just put it down?
It's funny you should ask that because I have always read a book from cover to end. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm personally giving up on something if I don't finish the book. I feel like I'm offending it. I think every book is a great book in its own right. In saying that, I have very recently given up my very first book.
Okay.
It took a long time. I love reading. I'm a big reader. I'm a quick reader. And I sat with this book for like 4 or 5 months just struggling to get into it. I'd heard so many amazing things about it when I bought it because I always put my books on my Instagram because a lot of my followers love to know what I'm reading. And I got so many people saying, oh my God, it's the best book in the world. You're going to love it. And I was like, oh, okay, amazing. I'm really excited about this book. And I started it and I was like, oh, this is a little bit, okay, this is tough. Okay, I'm just going to stick with it. I bet it gets better. And I sort of stuck with it, kept reading. Oh yeah, not loving this. And I just... Eventually, someone said to me, it was one of my good friends, John, who is also a very big reader, and he said, life is too short.
I agree.
100%. To waste time on a book you're not loving. Yeah. He's like, just put it down.
I wonder if he likes Naval Ravikant. This is a guy that he's a bit of a modern philosopher, I guess you could call him.
I can ask him.
Because it sounds like the line that he says.
Yeah, well, I was just really struggling with it. In fact, I suggested that he pick it up and try and read it because I wanted him to read it. And then if he said it was good, I'd give it another go. But he was like, no, put it down.
Yeah, now if it's shit, I give up. I just don't. Life is too short. Yeah. It really is. And I sort of treat them like blog posts now. Like if I just don't like it, I'll just leave it.
Well, I feel like I'm missing out because so many of my followers said it was amazing. And I'm like, what am I missing?
But the problem is that, like, this is why so many people don't read, right? So my partner, Lauren, she not hates reading, but she really struggles with it. And I think it's because a lot of people, they pick up a book and they go, right, I've got to finish this book. And a lot of the time, they haven't even worked out what type of books they like to read.
Yeah, right.
And I feel like that's sort of part of the, and I've thought about, because I found reading late in life, like I hated reading up until about, apart from Harry Potter, up until about 16, I hated reading.
I don't want to like hashtag all men, but I generally find that it's kind of the case with guys. Yeah. I have this joke with my friends. It's kind of like one of my first date gags that most guys have like one or all of three books on their bookshelf. Do you want to hear what they are?
Go for it.
Marching Powder.
Okay.
Every basic bitch has read that. When I say basic bitch, I mean basic guy. Marching Powder, Scar Tissue.
Okay.
Literally every single guy has read that book. And Steve Jobs' autobiography.
Yeah. Or Specky, or if they're really basic, Specky McGee.
No one's read that. The shoe one. Shoe Dog. The Nike
shoe
one.
Shoe Dog Millionaire?
No. The Nike.
I know the one you're talking
about. Nike. Yeah. The start of Nike. They are the books that most guys have. They're like the only books that most guys have read.
Yeah. That's a very good analysis. But I think you're right. I think a lot of guys are more interested in things than people.
They've got shorter attention span, let's be honest.
Mm. I've noticed as I've gotten older as well that it is stories and people that I like in particular. I think that is, I do think it's rare for a lot of guys to like that.
Mm.
They're just more interested in talking about things.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
How early did you realize that you loved stories?
Very, very early. My mom was a massive reader. She always had books all around the house. And I think it was important to her that I also loved books. I was always given books as presents. They were always a big feature in my bedroom. Beatrix Potter, I had the whole set of Beatrix Potter books. Millie Molly Mandy and of Green Gables, they were books that I was brought up with. And then as I got older, I've sort of said this speech at my mum's funeral recently, but we knew going out and going to the shops, we would never ask for a toy. We'd never ask for like a box of slime or a Lego set because we'd just never get it. But yeah. If we asked for a book, it was always a yes. Always. So I just started asking for books because I knew I'd get them.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I got them, I'd read them. I also discovered that I liked writing at the same kind of time, I guess. I loved books and I had books in my house. So I decided to write my own books and then sell them back to my parents. So it was from a very, very young age.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that you're just intrinsically sort of in love with that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I had a friend ask me recently for advice on how to become a better writer. and I just said, read more.
Yeah. Read more. Be more interested in stories in general. I think there's a talent to it that has to be, you know, sort of molded.
There definitely is a talent to it. I think that my particular writing style, it's very colloquial. Mm. Now that you've met me, I think if you go back and read any of my blogs, you can hear me in my writing. I write exactly how I speak,
yeah.
Inflection and all. Like, you really can hear me in my writing. And I think that that is a certain skill level. But, like, you know, in terms of writing a novel where I'm writing from maybe a different character's point of view and not my own voice, I don't know how I'd go with that.
Did you ever see yourself as becoming a novelist, or was it always in analysis?
No, I've never seen myself as becoming a novelist, but I've recently been asked to write a book.
Really?
Yeah, which blows my mind as much as it obviously just blew yours.
What, like, is it a biography or
yeah.
about a topic? Or?
No, like a book about me, my life.
And the title would be Misunderstood.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I don't know what the title would be. I think I was thinking more like, I've often been referred to as a storm in a teacup. That's my bio and my Tinder profile and Bumble profile. So,
yeah, a lot of people are like that too. But I think you're one of the most misunderstood people.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Talk me through this.
I just think it's more so to do with the level of influence that you had. So, look, when I was going through and doing questions, I think there's like, I think five or six key things that have happened to you that have really defined who you are. And one of those was obviously becoming an influencer, but it was really Big Brother that made that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Big Brother is a double-edged sword for everyone
mm-hmm.
who does it. It's not just for Tully, it's for the people who, when I'm reading an article about Tully and it says, you know, Tully was at this event, and then down below it's like, look at Bree Amer, what is she doing with her life now? Look, you know, like all that sort of stuff. It makes you a household name, but it also opens you up for people to just pile on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know, as you were saying to me off air, a lot of the criticism you've gotten isn't, I don't think it's really, it's not fair. It's always for a very small situation.
Yeah, I think that it's a bizarre thing to think about the fact that, you know,
like it's very micro. It's not the macro of Tully's life. It's just like, no. Oh, this thing that happened for,
I will forever,
less than 1% of her life,
yeah,
and defines
yeah,
her.
And that's terrifying, and that's something that's taken me a long time to come to terms with and be okay with, because it feels unfair. And statistically, it's not right. You know, to judge someone based off one thing they did 6 years ago, it just seems ludicrous. But that's unfortunately the case for me, and it's something that I've had to come to terms with and make peace with, because I will forever be known for that, and I will forever be held accountable to my actions as a 25-year-old.
Yeah, but also what I think is quite interesting is you've almost become like a weapon for you now. Like, you wear it in your armor, if that makes sense. Like, if someone says that, or if you see an article, I got to send, like, you are more forthcoming and talking about it than people are themselves.
Yeah, that's probably my line of defense. I sort of think if I beat them to it, maybe they'll go gentle with me. I think also,
but not a lot of people do that.
Well, it was a very conscious decision when I was evicted from Big Brother. I guess you could have taken what happened with me two ways, you know. And I think I've seen a lot of people since, not for the exact same circumstance, but for other circumstances, come out of a show like that and put their hands in the air and say, oh, you know, it was the editing. I'm not really like that. You know, a lot of Married at First Sight people say, oh, you know,
yeah,
it was all cut and change, and they put words in my mouth, and we hadn't slept all night, and blah, blah, blah. And I get that. I'm not saying that's not true. I know that that's how these things work. But it was very important to me, and it was never a decision. I never sat down there and thought, how am I going to play this? In my point of view, there was no other way of doing it, and that was that I was going to come out and I was going to cop it all. I'd made my bed and I was going to lie in it, and I never wanted it to go any other way. You know, the producers of the show and the network offered me all these sort of safety lines and safety nets and ways out. You know, they said, well, we can cancel your radio. Every evictee is supposed to do the footy show appearance. They went ahead and cancelled that without even asking me,
yeah,
because they were trying to protect me. And I said, no, I want to do all my radio interviews. And then when I did the interviews and they said, oh, you know, so, you know, what do you think you did? And do you own up to it? I said, yeah. I said, I fucked up. I said, I'm not a shitty human being, but I did a shitty thing. And it was all me.
But that's why you've survived it, though. Because so many people, like, this is the thing that, I look at it like the archetypical hero's journey, right? Like, you have sort of a situation and it's bad and you fall down and something happens and people are piling on. But in your case, you actually admitted that you were wrong. Whereas a lot of people just sort of clamp up. No one hears from them. They do no media.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that you did that was probably one of the smartest things that you did, because people couldn't own that over you. You did. You took responsibility for it. And so it's, yes, the Daily Mails, the Glossy Mags of the world will talk about it, but I don't think it's really the defining feature anymore.
I mean, I hope not. And I think that's very kind of you to say so. But if I'm being completely honest and frank, I mean, wasn't I just doing that to make myself feel better? I think that I felt like I needed to make penance. I needed to be punished. I wanted to... I felt really, really bad, and I felt really, really guilty, and I was not proud of my actions. And I think me coming out and putting my hand up and saying, yep, I stuffed up, I'm the bad guy, I deserve whatever you're going to throw at me, in a way I was trying to level the playing field. I was trying to say, yeah, I fucked up, and I deserve to be ridiculed. I deserve to be trolled. I deserve to be pulled apart in the media. I deserve it all. And I think that to this day I still think – you know, when I get the occasional remark or someone decides to leave a nasty comment, I sit there and I go, fuck, fair enough.
But that's what I mean, though. Like, so many other people would just say, you know, it's the editing's fault. It's someone else's fault. I think that's the difference, though.
But maybe that's my own inner, you know, guilt.
Maybe, but at least then it steered you on the right path.
There was no other, yeah. I mean, I couldn't see another way out. I couldn't sleep at night. If I'd come out guns blazing and saying, oh, I don't know what happened in there. It was crazy. It was such an alien environment. Ooh, who was that person? That's not just not the truth. That's not the case. And I wouldn't be able to live myself had I played it that way.
But that, again, that is the difference. Because
you're trying to give me more credit than I deserve, I think.
So many, I just
you're being very lovely about it. And I'm like, ugh.
I just know that, look, it's interesting because my favorite topic or areas is the fall of social media types and how this has been a new thing and how someone like
pylon culture.
Yeah. Like, do you remember that case of that lady who was going to South Africa? She's not by no means an influencer. Maybe she had a couple thousand followers or something like that. And it was saying, the joke was around saying like she was going to South Africa and she's like, I hope I don't get AIDS or something terrible. Right. And so, it was bad. Like,
that is just...
you wouldn't say it in public, right?
I wouldn't say that to my, I wouldn't say anyone. That under my breath.
So anyway, she put it under a hashtag. And so people found it and she was on a flight. And in the time for the international flight from New York to Cape Town, she'd lost her job, you know, this has started trending on Twitter. Like this woman's life was ruined. And in a lot of cases, people just don't admit that they did wrong.
Did she not admit that she did wrong?
I can't remember the specifics with that one, but there are other notable examples. I remember Sam Harris talked about this on his podcast. He talked about it with a psychologist, and there's been many high-profile cases. But it's fascinating with the way that we have social media now and how people can pile on like that. It's intense.
Yeah, I mean, I copped it pretty bad. I'm not going to lie. And I think even in hindsight now, looking back, there were some really, really dark days. Really dark days. And it was pretty brutal. Like, I'm talking bringing in my sick mum into the gags, you know, paparazzi stalking me, sunbaking toplet. Like, it was bad.
Yeah.
But even I still think that if it happened today, it would be even worse. It'd be a whole different level.
It would be on steroids.
And I do worry. And that's why I sort of have taken it upon myself to become this kind of like martyr figure for this new generation that are coming up. Because I see these young, naive, you know, fame hungry people go on shows like Married at First Sight and The Bachelor. And I just think, oh, you just don't know what you're getting yourself into.
Mm.
You're not being prepared. No one's warning you. You're not thinking about the future. You're so focused on right here in front of you that you're not thinking about here. And, yeah, it worries me because I know what it's like and how awful it can be, and they're just not prepared for it.
And I think that's why if you wrote a book called Misunderstood, it'd be super interesting. I would 100% read that.
Thank you. Okay, Misunderstood, that's a good working title.
I actually want to jump back to your early career because I think it was your career choice that it's obviously set you up to where you were going later on in life as an influencer and media personality now. Mm-hmm. I think you got quite the pedigree. Clemenger.
Yep.
DDB Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
You did your comms degree.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I was thinking because I know your mum worked in ad world.
You've done your research, yes.
Do you think that was sort of the real driving force behind why you chose that field?
No, I don't think it's funny because our whole family, we've come from a family of advertising people. My mum and my dad both worked in advertising. I ended up working in advertising and now my little brother works in advertising.
Does he really?
Yeah. Literally only one sibling has not ended up in advertising.
And what did he do?
He works in sales.
Okay.
He could sell ice to Eskimos.
Yeah.
Still advertising of some sort, just different advertising. But yeah, I mean, I always felt like even as a kid, I thought my parents had really cool jobs. I remember going to my parents' offices after work. We'd alternate between my dad's office and my mum's office. And dad was working on the Smacko's ads, the famous Smacko's ads. Shit. Yeah, dogs go wacko with Smacko's. And they had the plasticine figurines that are used in those ads, like, you know, around the agency. And I just thought that was so cool that I'd seen this ad and I was playing with this thing from this ad. And I remember thinking it was a pretty cool space to be in. And this is before like Mad Men was a thing.
Yeah,
like I didn't know how cool Adland really was back in the day. I just thought my parents were pretty cool. And I knew that they worked on some pretty cool ads. But I never wanted to work in advertising. Writing was always the one thing I knew I was good at. And so when it sort of came down to later stages in school and everyone was sort of figuring out, you know, what should we do? I knew I didn't want to do an arts degree because it was just too broad. And I was like, okay, what am I good at? Writing. That's basically all I can do. What is a degree that I can do where I write? Journalism made the most sense. So I did journalism for that reason. I also loved magazines. I think for a hot second, like most people my age, wanted to work in magazines because of movies like Devil Wears Prada and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that was the original dream, to work in magazines.
Yeah, I remember I had this whole thing. Man, it's so funny to think about this in hindsight. I did a fashion textile, like VCAL unit type thing, which is like, what do they call it?
Like an extra, as well as your school studies?
Like instead of a unit.
Yeah, I did that too.
It was a bad decision in the long run, like for getting into the course that I eventually did.
It pulls your curve down, right?
Yeah.
I did a similar thing.
So it was, God, I remember going to there was a girl from the sister school.
Who was cute, and so you thought you'd do that to me to her.
No. It was just like.
That's why I did debating.
She went with me, and like, we became good mates from that. I was never really into her, but she was.
It's tough for her to hear now, live on air.
I don't think she'll be listening to her. But we had a lot of fun because they used to give us cab charges to go to another school to do the unit because it was like at a
TAFE. And how annoyed does that feel like at the time? You're like, oh, I've got a cab charge. We could go anywhere with this.
So her mum used to take us and we used to take the cab charge. Like, as in we'd save it and we'd use it for other moments, like if we were going out or something like that. Just going to the city.
101. Like, that's just smart. That's not...
Anyway, so I did this course because I thought I'm going to be this hotshot tailor. So I thought I was going to be a tailor for a while. And I did it for a year. And then I got this thing in my mind. I'm like, oh, well, I really like talking and writing and business and stuff like that. Maybe I should, like, try get a job at, like an internship at GQ. Or
that's cool.
Rush or something like that. So, and then
how cool was Rush magazine?
Rush was sick,
so
man.
Cool.
So good. I remember, but I copped a lot of shit for liking it because it's just not.
It's a female fashion magazine.
Yeah. Rush and even GQ. You should have seen
Yen,
my
Yen was cool too. Like, I liked Yen.
Yeah, it was a bit too hipster for me.
Right.
I used to work
for FHM magazine.
Did you really?
I did, the men's mag.
Fuck.
That was one of my first internships.
When Lauren first met me, she thought I was gay straight away because my wall was like just posters of like very like stylish models in these amazing poses and then like some dude with some awesome... Like I was obsessed with Lapo Alkin. Do you know him?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. He was like my archetype.
I can kind of see why she maybe thought you were into dudes.
That's
not your typical bedroom decoration.
It's not. But I loved design and stuff like that. But, was my thing.
In hindsight, like, thinking about it, how can they expect 18-year-old kids to pick what they want to do for the rest of their lives?
Ludicrous.
Like, what the...
It's ludicrous.
Actually. And even, like, so, yeah, I studied journalism at Charles Sturt University in Bathurst. What up? I had someone message me the other day when they heard that I went to that university asking me where I lived on campus because everyone lives on campus. JOV, iHut, by the way. I studied journalism, but I wanted to work in magazines. And then I ended up... Overnight, it felt like there were all these ads for it was like, do you love social media? Do you love writing? And I was like, yes, I love both of those two things together. What is this new job? And I ended up, working at Clem's as a my title was social media superstar, which is just ridiculous.
Look, there's so many different titles, isn't there? Like looking through them, and then they're really very similar things. It's just different degrees of responsibility.
Well, yeah, I think. And I was such an early adapter that we didn't know what the hell to call what I did. You know, they didn't know where to put me. They didn't know what to call it.
What were your platforms that you were...
So, at the time, it was mainly Facebook.
Okay.
And a few YouTube channels.
Okay.
No Twitter. No, Instagram wasn't around. This was like early days.
It was, yeah. It was before... So, Instagram came out 2012, 13?
When I came out of the house in... End of 2013, it was still very much peer-to-peer. There weren't very many brands on there still. So it was really early days.
Where do you sit on TikTok?
I am not about it. I think I'm too old for TikTok.
I don't know.
Apparently it's blowing up. It's the next best. I don't know. First of all, I don't like video content in general. I don't know if you've noticed, but I don't do a lot of video content.
Yeah.
I have a YouTube channel, but it's mainly videos that I've made on trips that other really talented people have put together for me. When I do a piece to camera, if you ever see me on my Instagram talking to camera, just know that's taken me 100 takes to get.
Yeah. It's the same thing I've got. I can't. What is it about that you know?
It's just awkward. It feels self-indulgent. I'm always watching myself rather than looking into the camera, and I hate, I'm like, oh, why are you putting that face?
I do that thing where I look in the actual, like, I don't know where I'm looking half the time.
I look at my face. I'm not looking at the camera.
Yeah, so I'm like looking, and I'm meant to be looking at the camera, like, and Lauren's told me recently, like, oh, just set it up on, like, your laptop and just film it, because I'd be holding it, and I'd be like.
Yeah, so I use hands-free. It definitely helps, but.
I do that, but I'm a spastic at holding it.
I don't think you can use the word spastic in 2019.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. I'm not good. I'm really not good.
I just find it really awkward. So yeah. I feel like TikTok is just not the platform for me.
Yeah.
But if it's, you know, fuck it, if it's a cool new thing, fine, I'll get amongst it. But yeah, it just feels really, is that really going to become a thing?
I think it is.
I'm still using Snapchat just for its filters.
I feel like TikTok is the platform that has the most potential to supersede Instagram. At the moment.
That's terrifying. Don't say that. I'm not on board with that at all. Unsubscribe. Unfollow.
It's the most unique out of the platform.
It's just Vine. Rebranded.
That's what I mean, though.
How is that unique? We've already had this and no one was using it, and so they got rid of the platform.
Because Instagram does not have the... I don't know. I find it different. It's a different experience to Instagram. It's totally different.
Yeah, and that's why I don't like it.
It's a bit more culture-driven, and it's easy to be discovered on TikTok, which I think any platform with a network effect.
Of course it is. No one's on it.
Well, there's 2 billion downloads or something like that.
Yeah, but probably in like...
2 billion with a B.
Nah, I'm not into it. I'm going to fight it all the way. Just like I fought AirPods until yesterday.
I want to just touch on the thing about influence, because I feel like in your interview with Big Brother as you're going into it, that's where you really... Like, you already knew this stuff. You were sort of getting a hand of social media, but that interview is when you realized that you could... I don't know. Like, you were doing this interview and you're saying how you would say certain things and it would react for the producers.
Mm.
Do you feel like that's where you learned that you could really garner people's attention with the way that you conversed?
I mean, I guess I think I've always known, I've always kind of loved playing up to people. I know what to say to get a rile, you know, I know what to say to get a shock reaction. That's not to say that I was doing that during the audition process. I really wasn't. I just wasn't buying into the bullshit that everyone else was. Yeah. I wasn't drinking the Kool-Aid, and that therefore made me stand out. I don't think that's kind of a moment where I thought, oh, hang on, if I just keep being myself, I'm going to get noticed. But it's always been, I don't really have any other setting. You know, some people say, oh, you know, thanks for being so honest and open. Thanks for being so vulnerable.
It's just who you are.
I don't have another setting.
Yeah.
If I did have another setting, I would have gone much better on Big Brother. Like there are people in that house, I won't mention names. I spent 2 months with these people. And I thought I knew them. And then we got out of the house and we hung out. And I was like, holy shit. You literally had this. And they were still being themselves, just a much more refined, perfected, measured, thoughtful version of themselves. They were minding their P's and Q's. They were going, okay, we're on air. I won't say that. Whereas I was just like, ugh. It was what you saw is what you get is what I'm like 24/7. I just don't have another setting though.
Yeah. This is something I spoke with Jen about and she highlighted. And it's
about me or about her?
About you. Like, I asked her a few questions about you in general. I think that is a common theme. It's your vulnerability. But I agree. It's a really... I was thinking about how could we help... Because there's so many people who ask, like, how could you... How do you... You know, like, how can I be better at telling people things and blah, blah, blah. And I think, in a way, it's sort of just inherent.
I do wonder, though, whether... Me being so open and vulnerable on my social media channels now is a direct result of what I went through on the show. Because I think once you've been at that level, and I say it was my rock bottom, it was pretty bad. And I think once, you know, I felt like the country had seen me at my worst, they'd seen me make a colossal fuck up, they'd seen me hurt someone that I cared about a lot, they'd seen me you know, humiliate myself, hurt myself. They'd seen me in tears. They'd seen me anxious. They'd seen me at my worst. What do I have to hide after that?
Yeah.
When someone's seen you at your very worst, it's kind of liberating in a way. Like, why pretend that I'm having a good day if I'm not? You've already seen me cry for 10 weeks on air.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to pretend now that I have my shit together. You guys know better. But then I think about it and I wouldn't have been so emotional and stuff in the house if I was being guarded. So obviously I've been like this my whole life.
I think so. I think it's just one of those things that people have. Like I've always really, for me, it was, I've always like seeked people's approval. And so I would be always very open and vulnerable as part of that process. Like I would just give them everything.
Surely that comes back to our parents and the way we were brought up.
I think
as kids.
So. I think for me, it was always seeking my dad's approval.
Right.
I've only just really gotten over that in the last few years.
I mean, if you, yeah, I was speaking about seeking approval. I definitely feel as if I'm still trying to win back the country. It's a, I constantly feel like I'm trying to prove myself.
That's a good analogy.
That's what it feels like. I feel like they all assume this one version of me and I have to, I'm still here 6 years later going, wait, but no, I am a good person. There's more to me than that. I'm sorry. I made a mistake.
So it really was from Big Brother, you think?
Well, definitely this feeling of like trying to prove them wrong, you know, trying to show that I care about different charities and causes, trying to show that my vulnerability with my anxiety to help other people with their anxiety. I'm trying to show that I'm not this bratty, you know, selfish person that people sometimes think that I am.
And there's another chapter of Misunderstood.
Chapter two.
I want to talk about dementia. Before we talk about your mama, I just want to talk about dementia itself because when I originally emailed you, I spoke about my own family.
Yeah.
Scares the absolute...
Bejesus.
Yeah. You had a really interesting story about how you went to... No, your grandmother passed away and you couldn't take your mum and you had to repeatedly tell your mum. I can tell you with absolute assurance that is the smartest decision you guys ever made because my grandmother passed away in April and my uncle was there. Holy crap, man. That is something else.
Really?
Like it... And I felt... At the time, I was annoyed. I was actually annoyed at him, but I can't believe that I was annoyed at him. Like,
yeah,
so
but that's just part and parcel with this shitty disease, isn't it?
Yeah, he was just sitting there and he's like, oh, who's that?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, that's Jordan. And he's like, I know him. That's Tim's son. And then so like he was
so frustrating.
And it depends on the person as well because he's so happy. So at least we've got that. But I felt so bad for my cousin and, like, he would go up to my uncle and my dad when I was doing my, like, opening introduction to everyone before they do their speech and, like, he came up to me. He's like, isn't it so good to see each other? And it's like, oh, my God.
And there is this sense of, and it's hard to describe to someone who hasn't witnessed it or experienced themselves, but there is this sense of childlike wonderment. They really do regress. And when I say they regress, I don't just mean they're losing their skills. They go backwards. It's almost like Benjamin Button.
They turn
into toddlers.
Yeah.
The way they interact with you, with the world, the way they move, the way they, you know, like I remember mom would pick up a boiling hot cup of tea and try and drink it. Like it's literally like you're suddenly looking after a toddler. And so with you speaking like that, that's maybe people they're listening think that you're just putting on a funny voice, but that's what it's like.
That's what it's like.
It's this wonderment like, oh my God, like what are we all doing here?
Isn't this amazing?
And you're there going, oh my God, please shut the fuck.
It's both amazing and horrifying. I remember like we were out for lunch one time and sitting there and he's just like, what is this? What's this cheese?
Like he's never eaten it before in his life.
And it's like Parmesan. It's Parmesan.
Yeah.
We've had it plenty of times.
But it gets to, when do you stop? Do you just play along with it? Do you correct them? Like it gets to a point, I think initially your knee-jerk reaction is to correct them and say, it's Parmesan, you've had it a million times.
Yeah, my dad would do that and I would feel myself doing it and I felt awful every time I did it.
You're helping nobody. All you're doing is upsetting them, confusing them, making them feel stupid.
I just wanted to make them happy. Like I remember before my grandmother passed away, that's when you know it gets really bad. Obviously, she has no idea who you are.
Yeah.
And we were sitting there and we're having, tea and sort of like a, not a pound cake, but sort of they give, at those old people's homes, they give like the worst sort of cakes. And you know, she was saying these words. I don't know what it was, but that's the hardest.
It's gibberish. It's like hallucinogen, like it's gibberish.
Did you ever go to like, not a training session, but like an information set? I remember I went to like an info session that was run by a group. And it's through Dementia
Family
Australia.
Family and supporters of carers?
Maybe. But I remember like they were talking about how the way that they communicate is often indirectly a way of how they're feeling. And so that was really, really interesting. And so that helped me a lot. I think those groups are amazing and they would help you with sort of dealing with it.
I think so too. I think those groups are amazing. I know that my mum's care home that she was at, the last place she was at, had a weekly meeting with families of...
Really?
Yeah, but we didn't have access to any of that. Firstly, two different reasons. Firstly, we were very young. I was the eldest and I was 14, 15. What 14, 15-year-old is going to get out there and research those places herself? It wasn't something that I felt comfortable. Even now as a 31-year-old, walking to a place like that, I'd need to sort of build up a little bit of confidence. It's a bit of a daunting experience. So as a 15, 14-year-old, I'm not going to actively go out there and try and find a support group. It's just not something that you think about. You've got
it's
so much other stuff happening. I was in high school. Like, I've got so much other stuff going on in my brain. And to be quite frank, those initial couple of years, I was in denial. I didn't want to talk about it with my friends, let alone with a bunch of strangers. Secondly, because my dad, bless him, was so intent on taking care of mum at home, not even using a respite nurse or anything like that. We weren't even on any kind of government care. He wasn't privy to what was out there available to us. And if my dad, who was our carer, isn't privy, it's not filtering down to us. So it's only now as an adult, I'm aware that had I just jumped online and typed it into Google, I would have found a million, or even, again, Facebook wasn't around back then. I couldn't, these days, I could go into Facebook and type in dementia support group and probably get 20 groups that are in my area.
Yeah.
That wasn't around back then.
It's true. And it's... Yours is such a unique situation because of the fact that it is like early onset. My uncle,
I mean, it was 2002.
Yeah. My uncle has early onset frontal lobe dementia.
Yeah.
So it only affects that part of the brain, which is super. So it's really long, even though it's an early onset.
Yeah.
It's
just as devastating.
It's horrible. I remember my auntie just shared this. They did like a video on and him and his life, and I can't remember if it was Dementia Australia, one of those support groups, but yeah, it's shit.
Yeah,
it's fucking shit.
It's hard. It's gut wrenching. It's as I've said, sort of in a few chats now. I think that the worst part about it is that there's just no hope.
Yeah,
there is nothing to cling to. There is no silver lining. There is no positivity. There is no. It's just. You know, you're diagnosed and it's a death sentence. And it's a long, even with early onset, I mean, mum had it for 23 years. That is too long. Too long.
Long, long time. Yeah. And I mean, the way I start to look at it now, the only way I can look at it is that at least this is the worst it could get.
Yeah.
In terms of the situation. I mean, I feel like it's
going
to get...
What about if you and I get it? Is that not the worst that it can get?
Yeah, it could be, but... I don't know. Like, I think about that and I'm like, I had this conversation with my uncle the other day and he was like, well, you won't really know. So it doesn't affect you. It affects everyone around
you. I think we'll know.
You know in certain ways.
But. I can see it in my friend's parents and grandparents. I'm like a sniffer dog now for dementia. Yeah. I can see it from a mile away.
Do you notice it just in their mannerisms?
Everything. It's a blessing and a curse because I think with the baby boomers now, our parents are getting, that generation's getting older. And so what was early onset for my mother now is now not so early onset for our, I mean, my dad's 72. And
really?
Yeah.
God, he looks good for 72.
He will love you saying that.
No, seriously, you guys, there's a family photo of this. He's 72.
He's 72. Yeah.
Jesus.
So mum was 68 when she passed and dad's 72. So they were 5 years apart. But what was early onset and a bit of a shock and very unusual circumstance back then is now not so unusual. So it breaks my heart, but I know I'm going to hear, it's going to become more and more prevalent in my social circles.
Yeah.
But even like the other day, and I wrote a blog about this, Mamma Mia, I was watching the latest series of season of Orange is the New Black. And one of the main characters, I knew the minute the storyline was being set out for us, the first second of her having a weird mood swing or forgetting where I knew. I was like, they're going to give her dementia. She's got dementia. I can sniff it.
So now here's what I'm intrigued by. Do you think it is Like, do you think it's hereditary, or do you think, like, I know there's so many, like, for example, my grandmother had vascular dementia. That's clearly lifestyle related.
Yeah.
It's a fit. You're affected by a mini stroke or whatever. Whereas Alzheimer's is more hereditary, frontal lobe. They don't know. There's so many of them.
Well, that's even the fact that we have to have this conversation that we don't know more is terrifying. Like, why don't we know? Mm. Why can't I give you a definite answer on that? All I know is that the form of dementia that my mum has been, but isn't proven, can be linked hereditary, which means that I have a chance of having it.
May.
What I do know, I think from my, and again, you know, I go through phases of wanting to know everything about it and then phases of it causing me severe anxiety and just sticking my head in the sand and being like, this is just too much for me right now. And I think that's okay. I think that both are fine. Yeah. I've got friends who are like, why won't you get the genetic test? You're an idiot. I would get it.
Jesus.
And then I'm like, why would I get that?
Don't go doing 23andMe tests.
No, I won't be doing that. I could barely watch Still Alice.
23andMe is like this. Do you know what? It's like sort of an ancestry.
Yeah.
And then you can go do database checks and it checks like your hereditary stuff. I luckily don't have any of it. I got a feeling that most of the stuff in my family is related to lifestyle decisions.
Well, lucky you, mate. Lucky you.
Yeah, very lucky. But a lot of, as we know, like a lot of people, it's probably what, 50-50? You know, and particularly with Alzheimer's.
I think from what my last research, if I have the gene, then it's 100% that I'll get the disease. But I might not have that gene.
You sure?
Yeah. It's not a case of if I have the gene, then it might develop into Alzheimer's. If I have this specific gene, I could be wrong. Please don't quote me on this. As I said, I go through phases of reading stuff and then pulling back. But from my understanding, it's 50-50 that I have the gene. But if I have the gene, then it's 100% that I will get the disease.
Yeah.
Which is just grim.
That is, that's strange because my brother's.
But I also could get hit by a car tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? Like, I could die from cancer. Like,
life short.
People are like, I hope you're living your life to the fullest. And I'm like, I'm just living my life.
Yeah. It's all you can do.
What else? I'm not going to start, you know, skydiving every weekend just in case.
Have you thought more about what will really change this certain situation? Like the fact that a large portion of people are going to be affected? Simply research, or is it?
What upsets me is that I am now passionate about raising funds and awareness and research because I've lost my mother to it. Mm. And I've sat through it and I've had to watch my family deal with it for the last 23 years. So it's affected me personally. So now I'm fucking angry and I want to make a change. I'm trying to stop that from happening for anybody else. I'm like, guys, we need to act now so that you guys aren't affected by it down the track. And I'm really worried because it's the leading cause of death for females in Australia, and it's the second leading cause of death for Australians overall. Those are fucking terrifying statistics, and nobody knows about it. Nobody knows those stats. And when I say those, everyone's like, whoa, I had no idea. And I'm like,
it's going to be number one, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, like in a hot second.
It's why
it's crawled up from four. Yeah. So it used to be four like a year and a half ago.
Really?
Like, I can't tell you how quickly this is happening. It's about to become an epidemic and no one's doing a fucking thing about it.
Yeah.
Seth Rogen, his his wife's mother had dementia. I don't know if you've seen it recently. I was tagged in it yesterday.
I've seen him talk at Congress.
Yeah, so he's gone to Congress and he's spoken about it. But he's actually literally a friend of my brother's tagged me in it yesterday. He's having like a variety show to raise money for dementia.
Really?
Yeah, in the States, which I just think is phenomenal because, A, he's a popular person. He's a popular actor. He obviously has a great following behind him. He's relevant. He's young. He's hip. People will listen to him. And he's using, his skills and talents as a comedian and an actor and a celebrity, big time celebrity, to raise funds for dementia. So I couldn't be more thrilled, but we just need more of him.
Maybe we need to speak to Jen. Maybe we need to get something going.
I can't even get Dementia Australia to talk to me.
You're kidding.
Nope.
We need to go knocking down some doors.
I keep tagging them and everything and hoping that they're going to reply and that they're going to share my stuff. And it's been
not a word.
No, which I don't know. It's a bit odd.
It's something that I've thought about recently. I've thought about what I'm going to do with that inheritance. I'm thinking about whether I donate it. Do I create a show Like, that's, you know, when you talk about variety show, that intrigues the shit out of me. Think about the people that we've had on the podcast that may consider getting involved. I don't know. Something around that is interesting.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I just think anything we can do. And yeah, I'm, as I've said before, it's not cool. It's not trendy. People don't want to talk about it. People, you know, there isn't a daffodil day. There isn't a go buy a pink finger bun. It's going to go to breast cancer awareness. And those are all fantastic. And I support them wholeheartedly. I do. I buy the daffodil. I buy the red nose. I buy the finger bun. Mm. There's just nothing like that for dementia. Like, do we, you know, I think the flower of dementia is a forget-me-not, which is just fucking ironic.
I think there is...
Do we even get forget-me-nots here in Australia? Like, we need to have some kind of something we can do or wear or a day where we think about... We've got nothing.
What's the item? I'm thinking about something like people are allergic to walnuts.
Well, there's a reason... There's a reason that there is a big giant stuffed elephant as like the mascot for Dementia Australia, because elephants have great memories.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Not just a pretty face. But yeah, I don't know. There needs to be something, because right now we've got nothing.
And I can see Dementia Australia doing a Benjamin Button style ad campaign.
Oh my God.
That would be... No, seriously, that would hit
home. I don't know if that would fly. Is that like on the nose, or is that...
What do you mean?
I don't know. I don't know if people would understand that.
That's a good point. I don't know. There's some... Yeah, but if you've got the tagline at the end...
Do you know what the best ad for dementia is? Just fucking play The Notebook on repeat.
Everyone's
always like, oh, The Notebook's so sad. He loved her so much and she forgot him. I'm like, that's my fucking reality.
Yeah. That's a good one. A very, very good one.
I can't watch it.
Yeah, I've never watched it for that very reason.
Don't watch Steal Alice either. That is all kinds of fucked up.
What's that about?
Steal Alice is the film about a woman who gets early onset and her three children and how they deal with that and whether they get tested or not. She is played by Julianne Moore and she won an Oscar for her performance. It's bang on. It's basically my childhood. I watched, I think, 20 minutes and I was hysterical. I couldn't watch the rest.
Yeah. Those movies, I think any movie where you've been directly affected by the thing within it will get you back.
Especially if they're done well. If you know, if someone has lived it and you can tell that the writer or whatever has lived through it, it's just a bit too close to home.
I think, you know, all this stuff has happened in your life in the last month. I think we were speaking about that in the kitchen. Your mum passed away and then you recorded this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I get a sense that you're sort of... And I know from past interviews you've been putting it out there that you don't want to just be known as an influencer anymore. And I think, like, going with the podcasting route could be your thing. Like, because you are, like, I know you're aware of it, but you can, you're a good conversationalist, but also you can judge people really well.
Thank you.
So it's going to be interesting. What's your assessment so far on the social squad?
Well, you know, I was telling you downstairs that it was absolutely terrifying for me. It all happened, yes, so quickly. My mum passed away on the Monday. Come the Friday, I was in the Mamma Mia offices having a meeting, which is just a whirlwind in itself. But I knew it was something that I really wanted to do. I was actually off. I'd love to work in radio. That was kind of the dream for a while there. And then as I was doing more and more podcasts, I was like, hang on, this is way better than radio because I can babble on for as long as I want, generally speaking. We can talk about topics that I care about that are really close to my heart. We don't have to cut to an ad break or throw to a song or you know, talk about a sponsor. I was like, this is like the best of all the worlds. Plus, I'm still being able to talk and tell my dumb anecdotes and hear the sound of my own voice. I was like, this is amazing. This is like all the things that I love to do. And the more that I did them and was a guest on them, the more I wanted to do them. And I actually had a guy come and offer me, say that, you know, I think you'd be a great podcast host. I wanted you to do your own podcast. And I pulled out last minute. I had a bit of a crippling, I guess, self-doubt that just made me feel like I wasn't good enough and that no one would want to hear from me and that I didn't have much to offer and I didn't have anything to say. And it was literally, we'd shot the promo stuff. Everything was go full steam ahead. And I just pulled the plug. I just said, no, I can't do it. And that, you know, forget Big Brother. That was probably my biggest regret. That was a while ago now. And every time I thought about it and every time I sort of, people would say, why are you doing a podcast? I'd think about it. And I was like, why did you turn that down? Like,
how long ago was this?
Probably about a year and a half ago.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I just choked. Wow. I completely choked and I just had a complete meltdown internally, and I just was like, why? No one's going to want to listen to that. And I pulled out. I completely fucked this poor guy around. We'd done it. I'd paid for a shoe. We'd done everything. It was, and I choked, and I, it was a huge regret. I felt really shit about it. I wasn't happy with the fact that I'd pulled out. It didn't sit well with me. I was sad. People kept saying to me, I think it was after the Shameless podcast, people were really like, why aren't you doing this? Mm. You have such great stories to tell. You tell them really well. You're interesting to listen to. And I was like, oh, fuck, I don't know. Why aren't I doing this? And then so to be asked to come in for Mamma Mia and speak with them about a podcast, it was an absolute yes. But I knew how these things worked. And despite the fact that I was going through quite a difficult time in my life, I knew that if I didn't make it for that meeting, they would just find someone else that was just as good and I'd miss out. Mm. So I was really determined to go in for that meeting. And I probably wasn't in the best headspace. And in hindsight, I was definitely a bit manic that in that first instance. But I apparently killed it, and before I knew it, I was back up in Sydney recording back to back and talking about the wonderful world of influencing and everything that goes on behind closed doors. But it was really out of my comfort zone. Like,
yeah.
I'm used to being very good at what I do. I'm used to coming in and nailing it and people saying, oh, you were great, that was awesome, and I didn't feel like I was great, and it was tough.
When you think about the fact that you've sat down, what, with 10 or 12 people now? What's the biggest insight about influencers that you've pulled from that?
Do you know what? I don't think I realized the fact that we are actually just busy. It's so ingrained in me to feel ashamed about the title. The way people talk about it, the way people ask me about it, the way people, you know, the media, the way people portray influencers about how the fact that we don't do anything, we don't work hard, we don't have a real job, that's made me feel embarrassed and ashamed about saying that I'm an influencer. But meeting all these amazing women who are so brilliant, so talented, so hardworking, so switched on, I'm like, hang on a minute. We're just fucking business savvy women. Like, we're just business women that are working for ourselves, and fuck everybody else that makes us feel small about it, because we're doing it. We're working our fucking asses off.
The way I look at it is you're sort of like one man band ad agencies.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I said that in my article that I wrote the other day for Mamma Mia. I said, back in my day, when I was a teenager, we would all, you know, pore over a magazine, Girlfriend magazine, Dolly magazine, whatever, and we'd all go through the pages and we'd pick our favorite bikinis and we'd, you know, maybe rip one out so we'd, you know, remember which one it was and go buy it from Grace Brothers or, which is now Maya, or David Jones or Surf, Dive and Ski or whatever. And that's how the brands advertised their wares. Now, the teenagers are just on our Instagram pages, and the brands are not having to pay the models, the hair and makeup, the stylists, the photographers, the graphic designer, and then the magazine for the ad. They're just coming straight to us and paying us to do the content for them.
Yeah.
Why is that frowned upon?
Yeah. You're like a high profile columnist in Yen and
yeah,
Rush.
Yeah, I'm like a one-stop shop. But yeah.
But I think brands know that. I think brands really fucking savvy about it.
Or we wouldn't be getting paid to do what we do. It's just this.
It's just I think it's just the media.
No, it's not even the media. It's the public are the worst. I think there's just this tall poppy syndrome of like, and I get it. You know, you've got people that are slugging it out day in, day out at jobs that they hate, or they're working stupid long hours in the emergency department, saving lives, doing really important shit. And then they see me another fucking holiday, wearing a bikini and getting paid to do that. I'd be pissed off too.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you could look at it as well that
it's like me. I see the Jenners and I'm pissed off.
I don't know.
I see Kylie Jenner and I'm like, fuck you.
I just started taking SSRIs like a month ago. So like everything I see now is like super positive.
Oh, that's good.
So I reckon people actually look, a lot of people look at it, most people, and they go, well, it's sort of a bit of escapism, mm-hmm. Whereas I think it's just certain people in the media that drum it up as a bad thing, honestly.
Well, I'd like to think that my page isn't about escapism. I try to keep it as like normal as possible because I am just like everybody else.
When I say escapism, I mean like, you know, people can relate to what you're doing. They can relate to your life, whatever it may be. It's just, it's something that, you know, maybe they'll just never be there for whatever reasons, but for them, it's just nice, and they look at it and they're like, oh, well, isn't this nice? She's on holiday. Maybe I'll go do that.
I mean, I hope so. I hope it's sort of like a bit of a bucket list, Pinterest board, one day I'll get there vibe, and not like a, Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as I said, and the reason I got the podcast is because I still struggle with it myself.
Mm.
So who better to sort of pull it apart than someone who is struggling with the whole concept herself?
Tell me about Mia. I found her interview with you fascinating. I got to say, she's probably one of the smartest, up there as one of the smartest media operators in the last 20 years. The fact that she built that business, really, her and her partner.
Yeah, her husband, Jason.
Is fascinating to me. Love to interview her. But
she'd happily have a chat with you. You have to go up to her office in Sydney.
I would, yeah. And I know you sort of, you grew up really admiring her. Do you feel like now that you've sort of got this figure in your life that you sort of always wanted to have and you're just going to milk it for...
Do you know what? It's such a pinch me moment. It's surreal. And it actually wasn't until the other day when I was typing up my caption when I was promoting my No Filter with Mia that I thought, holy shit, like I literally grew up reading her ed column in Cosmo magazine, thinking she was like, that's what I wanted to do. That's the reason I went and did journalism. It's the reason I studied textiles. I wanted to work in fashion. I wanted to work in fashion magazines. And she was it. She was Queen Bee. And she was 24 years old. She was younger than what I was when I went into Big Brother. And that seems like I was a child in Big Brother. And I've, followed her journey through Mamma Mia. And, you know, she's, I think the best part about Mia and what we bonded over when I first met her was that we've both fucked up pretty monumentally in the public eye. We've both done things that we regretted that we wish we hadn't, but we've both owned them. Mm. You know, she went through a really dark period with a couple of things, decisions that she made, and I've obviously gone through my own stuff. End of the day, she is so passionate about what she does. She is so passionate about women. She really lives and breathes it. Like, this is not just, you know, some tagline that she whacks on that website. She is the living and breathing, you know, she drops the taglines like they are going out of fashion. If she says walk in her shoes one more time, like she wants everyone to write as if we're walking in someone else's shoes. There are taglines all over the bathroom doors. There are free tampons in the toilet. Like she really lives and breathes this ethos. And she does it all whilst wearing a sparkly blazer and glitter on her face. Like she's amazing. And I think that I had some reservations. I was a bit apprehensive just because of how the media had portrayed her and some of the things she'd said and done in her recent years. I was a little bit wary going in to meet her. But she blew me away. She's so warm. She is just enthralled with every single body's. She wants to hear everyone's stories. And she very quickly took me under her wing and she said to me, she's like, you know, I see something in you and I want to be your mentor. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to help you with them. And that.
Yeah. What was that?
I just can't even put it into words. It's like, it's making me get up teary because I grew up loving her and to have someone now that I can WhatsApp, like we WhatsApp, like we're besties and we've been besties for life, to be able to roll ideas off her and to brainstorm with her and to work underneath her and alongside her. I wish I could go back and tell myself that because that's the dream.
Yeah.
And it's so surreal that I'm getting to do that.
It's quite amazing. I feel like it'd be similar as if, somehow I was working with I don't know, like an Eddie Maguire or Gary Vayner, like one of those high profile media types.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I just feel like I'm learning from the best. Like I can't.
Just, yeah.
Love her or hate her. And I know she's polarizing, but so am I.
Yeah. You don't have to agree with her politics, but she knows what she's doing. Like she knows what's up.
But she does it in such a, I think I've worked with and I've viewed other females in the media. I won't mention any names who know what they're doing, but they do it. They will crawl over whoever they can to get to the top. They don't care who they trample on. They don't care who they fuck over. Mia is not like that at all. Like she is all about building each other up, supporting each other. You know, it's funny. The girls in the Mamma Mia office say, working with Mia is like this. She'll come in. I swear she has ADHD. She has a million and one things going on in her brain at one time. And she'll come in and she'll do an interpretive dance for you. Generally wearing something with glitter on it. She won't actually dance. But this is what it's like dealing with Mia. She'll run into the office. She'll like spurt a million brain thoughts off at you. Basically do an interpretive dance. And then she'll prance away. And then everybody is left behind trying to figure out exactly what the fuck she wants us to do. That's what it's like to work for Mia Friedman. But it's amazing. And I love it. And every day is different.
What do you hope to learn the most from this new stage in your life?
I've already learned so much. From talking to Mia, being interviewed by Mia, I was picking up so much just the way she interviews.
What in particular stood out from that interview?
She has a knack of making you feel like it's just you and her, you know, in your bedroom having a girl chit chat. I honestly had to retract some stuff from my no filter because I felt so comfortable that just everything was pouring out. Things that I have not told anyone else. She has this way of making you feel as if it's just you and her, and she just wants, you know, you're just filling her in a little secret of yours, and you're like, fuck, actually, this is being recorded. I've learned so much from Mia. I've also learned a lot from Rach Corbett, who is head of podcasting.
Uh-huh.
She is a powerhouse. I am so just like star-eyed about her. I follow her around the office like a little puppy dog. I've watched her give a few presentations. I gave a dummy interview. I interviewed her. She's just, I think she is just amazing, and I've learned so much, and I'm so lucky to be working underneath her as well.
Former Big Brother alumni
I didn't know this.
Really?
Okay.
Neither did I.
I'm so embarrassed. I didn't know this.
Do you know, when I was doing my research, I went and looked, and so it had recommended people, and I'm like, Rachel Corbett.
I know.
And then all these other people, and I'm like, oh, shit.
Like, I watched that series. I remember her back then, but she was so young. She looks so different now.
But what it also made me realize is Big Brother was such like a kingmaker show.
Mm.
Like it really made people. So long as that person took it in their, you know, like if they just sort of grabbed it by the horns and went with it, they had a media career. Like, look at how many people have media careers after
that. But I really feel like it's more, I don't know if that's the case, because when she was on the show, none of this was a thing, and she worked her ass off behind the scenes to get to where she is today. It wasn't like Big Brother was a huge springboard for her in that regard. I think it's more of a case of, if you're the kind of person who's going to put yourself forward for a show like Big Brother, you're probably the kind of person that's going to go ahead and excel in other public aspects. You know what I mean?
It gives you a platform.
Not even that. I think it's more a personality trait. Like, not everybody is the kind of person that feels comfortable or that wants to voluntarily put their hand up and go get filmed 24/7 for 10 weeks or whatever it was. I think if you're the kind of person to do that, you're probably also more inclined to end up in the media.
So it's a platform for people who could potentially be in the media.
It's like a platform for show-offs.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm comfortable enough to go be filmed 24/7, I'm probably going to want to end up in radio or TV. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Do you know, just on the point of looking at previous contestants, you remember Hot Dogs?
I do remember Hot Dogs. Everyone loves talking about fucking Hot Dogs. His name's Simon Daring, and he works in real estate in Perth.
Yeah. It's amazing looking back at some of the characters and like what they did for the few years afterwards. I remember he had that show.
Yeah, he had Up Late with Hot Dogs.
That's right.
Like a game show from like 11 p.m. to like 1 a.m.
Yeah.
It's funny because I grew up with the show. I never pretended I didn't. When, you know, so many people are like, oh, I never watched the show before I was on it. Bullshit.
Yeah.
You don't go on a show that you didn't watch. I loved the show. Big fan of the show. And to the point where I am super starstruck and in love when I see, like when I saw, Ryan Fitzgerald and I, Fitzy from Fitzy and Whipper in Sydney, we're now kind of friendly, and I loved when I first met him. I remember I was in the house and I kept saying that I had a crush on him because I thought that maybe they'd drop him in as like an intruder. And when I first met Chrissy Swan, I was the same. I was completely like starstruck and obsessed with her because I grew up with those people.
Mm.
So yeah, I was super excited to meet people like that. And I was obsessed with Blair McDonoghue, who was like on the first, he was so hot.
Yeah.
He's now like an actor.
On KickPod.
I hope if I keep saying it, maybe he'll reach out to
me. It'll just sort of
filter down.
Affirm everything in the universe.
Maybe. No, he's got a wife and kids.
I know. So what's the future look like for you? What are you excited about?
I'm really excited about this podcast. It dropped today. The first episode went live today.
By the time this goes out, it'll be probably episode 3.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm just really proud of it. It's, as I said, it's the first thing I've been proud of in so long. I've been feeling kind of not ashamed, but not loving what I'm doing. And that, you know, having pride in your work and being proud of what you're achieving and going to work and feeling proud of what you're achieving at your job is really important for self-confidence, for, you know, for feeling like you're fulfilled in life. It's so important. I just haven't felt that for so long.
Mm.
And so to feel proud of something, to work really hard at something and then to have it come off and then to have someone tell you that it's kind of okay, it's a level of job satisfaction that I haven't had in so long.
Just a caveat, you told me in the kitchen that it's been so quick that you haven't even really, like, until they're ready to go,
any of them.
You don't get to hear it because it's that quick.
I'm hearing it with everybody
else. As they're done.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's terrifying in itself.
I think you may, with the things that you've done, whether it's your career, the things that you had to deal with your mum and dementia, Big Brother, becoming an influencer, I think you may have found the thing that sort of suits all of your traits. So it's going to be interesting to see, one, do you guys do another season? But two, if you don't, do you start your own show? On your own.
I would definitely like to do that. I think what I learned doing this show is that maybe interviewing isn't my forte.
Mm-hmm.
I love to talk.
Conversation.
Yeah, I love to talk. And obviously it's important when you're an interviewer to steer the conversation, to steer the, you know, you want to make sure that we're hitting all the sort of topics we want to talk about. But I would love to just do a show where I just talked shit for an hour with someone. Like, you know.
With someone or on your own?
Either or, really. I could just talk to myself. I don't know, just something that's a little bit more free-flowing, I think, is just where I can just chat.
Well, if who knows, maybe Shameless Media will come knocking on the door and be like, we've got an idea. I don't know, I could see that. I can see a conversational, like a lot of the comedians in America and Australia here have their own shows, and it's a lot of the time it's just them, just talking.
Well, that's what the original show was going to be, just me.
Oh,
and
really?
I think that's why I choked. I think I panicked that I wouldn't be able to hold my own, that I would run out of things to say, that I'm not interesting enough. But now that I've done a series, I'm like, I got plenty to say.
Well, we're going to jump into some rapid fire questions.
Okay. I'm scared now.
I'm intrigued.
I've purposely not been reading your notes backwards so that I don't like.
Yeah. How many pages of notes do you think I've got here?
I have been told by my manager, Jen, that you are very prepared.
Yeah.
That you come very prepared and to be prepared for that.
Did she freak out when she came
All
in?
I can read from where I'm sitting is get photo together in big, bright red letters.
Do you know why that's there?
Because you always forget to do it.
Exactly. I remember hearing Laura say that in your interview. I am hopeless. And Lauren's like, get the fucking photo.
It's important.
Yeah. Just a bit of social proof and yes, that I'm actually a person that exists.
Yeah.
All right. What does your morning routine look like?
Oh, God. Training. I get up at 6:30 and I train, and then I come home and have breakfast because I am famished after working out.
Okay. What's breakfast normally?
Eggs.
Yeah?
Yeah, just
like
eggs.
Poached, scrambled.
Dippy eggs.
Oh, like soldiers.
Okay. Because I'm 31 years old.
You don't put, it's just butter, yeah? Not Vegemite as well?
Don't fuck it up with the Vegemite. Just a lot of butter though, Lauren, like stupid amounts of butter.
I can't remember what Lauren did, but she used to do half and half. She's the same. She loves the little dippy eggs. She's obsessed with
it. You know what?
It.
You have not said you'll be surprised once this whole chat.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go.
There's still time.
You'd be surprised. what does your evening routine look like?
I'm a night owl. I suffer from insomnia. So it's dragged out, that's for sure. I try to get into bed into a pretty reasonable hour, like at least be in bed, but I don't sleep for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I generally read. I like to put my phone down and read a book before bed just to kind of switch my mind off a bit. And then I meditate. I have a guided meditation that I put on to try and help me sleep.
What's your do you have a go-to app or do you just
I do. I have a go-to app and I have a go-to meditation. I listen to the same one every night.
Okay.
It's Insight Timer is the app.
Uh-huh.
And I can put the link or something to the actual meditation. It's a very soothing voice. It has to be female. It has to be English.
Okay.
Dude voice is crooning me to sleep. It's a bit creepy. Yeah. I'm like, get out of my ear hole.
I know what you mean. There was one guy though that I used to listen to. It wasn't Russ Harris. He's got that book. It's a Scottish, hypnotist.
Right.
And it was really, really well known.
I don't want to be hypnotized before bed.
So it's funny you mention that because when I had I had food issues and they sent me to like a psychologist and all that because it's mainly connected to like anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But
isn't everything?
It, pretty much most things. But they send you to, they do give you like hypnotherapy. It really works.
Okay. So I've, hand on heart, seriously looked into hypnotherapy to get over an ex.
Really? Yeah. It may not do that.
Why can it help you sleep and not get over an ex?
It makes you, I don't know what they said, it just, because you're in the mood and you're in the mood for relaxing.
I'm in the mood to get over this dumb fuckboy. I'll tell you that right now.
I don't know though. It's like that to me sounds like a really deeper topic.
That to me sounds like you need some serious help.
Yeah.
We haven't got all day.
No. All right. What's in the fridge at home?
Oh. My part of the fridge or my housemate's part of the fridge?
Your part.
Okay. Not a lot. My one vice is Coke. I drink a lot of Coca-Cola. And so I usually have the baby Coke cans in the fridge because I like to convince myself that if I'm having a baby Coke can, it's better than having a full Coke can, except that I'm having two or three baby Coke cans.
Okay.
So I may as well just have a normal size Coke can.
How much are you spending on Deliveroo, Uber Eats
a lot.
Per week?
A
are you beating
lot.
Jen?
Hands down beating Jen.
You sure?
I sometimes order it four times a day. Like I order it for every meal plus like dessert.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's bad. It's really bad.
What's your go-to? Like at the moment, I'm obsessed with sushi tacos.
No, don't. Why combine two things that are great?
It's pretty good.
No.
I'm not going to lie.
Disagree.
Like as in it's not a...
I understand.
It's like the
it's
thing.
Very easy to figure out. It's sushi and fucking taco. I get it.
I don't know. I quite like it.
Clearly.
What's your go-to?
It depends on the day. I have favorites for different days. I tend to find that on Mondays I'm feeling something like lighter, like a salad or like just some raw salmon, like because I've had a big weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
And then come like Wednesday, Thursday, I'm ready for like a pasta, like a gnocchi, mushroom gnocchi. And then on the weekend it's usually like a pizza or something.
What's your go-to sort of gnocchi place?
I can get it. I think it's Topples, T-O-P-L-E-Z. It's on Chapel Street.
Topples? Topolino's or Topo?
No, Topolino's is in St Kilda. Yeah. Also a great place. No, this one's called like Tolples or something. Topples. T-O-L-P-E-Z.
Okay. Don't mind a good gnocchi.
Their fungi gnocchi is delicious. Mm. If you can get it here, you probably could. It's delicious.
Maybe. It might not be close enough.
It's worth going there.
For Deliveroo, definitely. Uber Eats mainly. Maybe. Best purchase under $200.
Ooh, that's a good one. Oh, that's not under $200. Damn it, I'm breaking the rules. Do you know what? I was given this.
Okay.
But if I wasn't given it, I would have happily bought it. And now that I've been gifted one, I 100% back it. SodaStream.
Yes. Very wise.
That's me trying to get off Coca-Cola. I'm trying to like stop having Coke and start having soda, like bring it right back.
What's your mixer though?
I just have nothing, no mixer.
Really?
Yeah. But it's the best thing I was ever given. I make soda water every day.
My thing at the moment to stop myself having bad things at night is lemon lime bitters, like lemon juice, lime juice and bitters. I don't know why.
Yeah, you're like a mother.
Yeah. I interviewed this guy who works in bars and he's like, you should only ever have one Angostura bitters bottle in the house that lasts your whole lifetime or something like that.
So we're only having a dash of bitters then, like not even a dash.
No, he's just, I think he just hates it.
Oh, right. Fair enough. Yeah. Right, right.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Last question for you. If you could have a billboard anywhere in Melbourne, where would it be? And what would it say?
Oh, my God. Okay, it has to be the billboard on top of that amazing...
the Nilex
thing? Yep, yep, yep. You knew what I was talking about.
As you come down Punt Road?
Yep, yep. Yeah. So I live in Paran, and I love that Nilex building. To me, my ex-boyfriend lived on Darling Street, so he kind of, as you drove down and up, you looked right onto the Nilex. So to me, it makes me feel all, like, warm and fuzzy about Melbourne in general because it just makes me feel like, oh, I love Melbourne and I'm so lucky to be living here. Guys, if you don't know the Nilex building, it's like this rundown, like,
what did it
rusty...
used to be, like a silo of grain
it's
or something?
It's not pretty, but to me, it has special meaning.
It's actually an amazing spot for a billboard, isn't it?
Right.
When you come down Punt Road, like...
You can see it from everywhere, though, not just from Punt Road.
I know, but, like, it's one of the most amazing views you can get in Melbourne, I reckon.
I agree, which is why I picked it.
Yeah.
And on it, I mean, it's going to sound really cliche and a bit...
Don't say it.
Well, no, it has to promote my podcast.
Okay. Like, it can't be something about a product or a podcast.
What, just, like, a personal saying that I like?
Whatever you want. Could be a photo of you for
all I don't
want to.
Actually, do you know what? It would, okay, if it's not promoting a product, one of my products or my podcast, Social Squad, out now, it would be a campaign to get me on The Bachelorette.
Okay. Yes, I've heard this.
It would be a photo of me in a red dress because I always put them in red dresses, either holding some roses or like red heart balloons or whatever else they do. And it would be a campaign to get me as the next Bachelorette.
Sounds like a job for Jen.
Mate, I've been putting it over for the last 3 years. She's not getting me anywhere.
Tully, look, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you on the interwebs?
At @TTEE_Smythe, S-M-Y-T-H, and that is across the board. So that's Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, everything.
And TikTok soon?
Absolutely not TikTok.
All right, Tully, thanks so much.
Thanks.
thank you for making it to the end. Before you run off, subscribe if you enjoyed this episode, or do leave us a rating. For Instagram, go follow us on @uncommon_podcast. For YouTube, search Uncommon Podcast, and don't forget to subscribe if you're watching this video. Also, give us a like or leave a comment on what you thought about the episode. But until next time, thanks so much for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON.